Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted because with us today is an old friend, Maggie Mancinelli Cahill, producing artistic director for Capitol Repertory Theater, which was just named Best Theater Company by the Albany Times Union and took 2 of 3 Best Local Play Nods. Maggie Mancinelli Cahill has directed more than 100 productions for the Rep, including the world premiere of William Kennedy's Grand View, as well as To Kill a Mockingbird, Race, Red, My Fair Lady, Hank Williams' Lost Highway, The Taming of the Shrew, Moonlight and Magnolias, The Crucible, Intimate Apparel, Metamorphoses, Terra Nova, I Love You, You're Perfect, Now, Change, Nora, A Christmas Carol, and such classics as Cyrano de Bergerac, Miss Julie's Doctor, Faustus, The Seagull, The Importance of Being Earnest, and Molière's Don Juan. She's worked on and off Broadway before assuming the role of producing artistic director with Capitol Repertory Theater in 1995. Maggie served as producing director of Urban Stages in New York City, as artistic director for Theater Under Glass in Denver, worked at Aspen's Playwrights Festival, Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., Sierra Rep, Renegade Artists, and on the staffs of the Women's Project and the Ensemble Studio Theater in New York City. She taught acting at the National Theater Institute at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Connecticut. Maggie received a Director's Project Fellowship from the Drama League of New York and holds an MFA in directing from Columbia University. She was honored by the Albany Colony Regional Chamber Women's Business Council as one of the 100 Women of Excellence, was awarded the Distinguished Leadership Award by the Chamber and the National Association for Community Leadership, and received the 2011 Norman Rice Award for Excellence in Arts, Culture, and Education by the Downtown Albany Business Improvement District. Welcome, Maggie, and whew, that was a lot.
To think that I'm only 29, it's amazing how much I've done.
Well, I love you now as I've always loved you, and I am so happy that you're here and that you're with us. You are an institution in Albany, and, you know, every good thing that an honor that has come your way is deserved, believe me. So tell us a little about yourself so we can get started. Where were you born?
I was born in San Pedro, California. I'm an Army brat, and so I was only there for a little while when we moved to Monterey, and then my dad got stationed over in Germany, and 2 years later I lived there.
Do you speak fluent German?
Oh, yes, of course, from my many years as a child there. No, not a word.
Yeah.
But then we came back to the States, and I lived in Colorado and California a few times, Fort Huachuca, Arizona, and I ended up spending most of my life as an adolescent and forward in Denver, Colorado.
Oh, I understand about being an adolescent for the rest of your life. I share that with you. So let me start by asking, did you go to college?
I did. Someone let me in. I did 2 years at, though that makes it sound like a prison. I went to Colorado Women's College for 2 years, but I actually graduated from the University of Colorado with a BA in theater. And then I got an MFA in directing from Columbia University.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how much does education help you to do your work?
I think it's critical. I'm a big believer in people getting educated. And I think that, you know, I'm a voracious reader of plays. I always think I know a lot about very little. And so I love talking with people like you because you know a lot about a lot. But I know a lot about a little. But college made me learn more about the world. And I still think it's a very, very important aspect of life for young people. So I'm very happy that I went. Yes.
So how did the drama thing occur? I mean, what made you say, okay, I want to do this?
Well, you know, I have to tell you that I heard your wonderful interview with Julie Boyd, who, of course, is a colleague of mine. And I love the fact that she said she was sort of inspired to go into theater in sixth grade. And it made me think, I think it was sixth grade for me, too, but not in the same way as it was for Julie. For me, I got to be the assistant director of the holiday pageant in the sixth grade
class. And what did you have to do in that?
Oh, it was a very important role, you know. I got to tell people where to stand, and I got to open and close the curtain on cue. And I knew...
Were you tall?
I was not tall, but I was obviously bossy. I mean, this is key to being a theater director.
You said you were obviously boxy?
No, I'm bossy.
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 Oh, okay, yeah.
I'm bossy, right. Yeah. So I realized in sixth grade I like telling people what to do, and it hasn't changed. And that's very important as a theater director.
So does it give you a surge of power when you tell somebody what to do?
No, because what you really learn is that in a theatrical production, you can tell people what to do, but they have to want to do it. And so you have to learn how to become a very good motivator. You have to understand people. You have to walk in the other guy's shoes. And
what if they're a jerk?
You know what I've found out? Most people who are talented aren't jerks.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a little counterintuitive.
Okay. There's some jerks.
Okay. So what happens when
they're not really talented.
What happens when Maggie runs up against a jerk?
You know, I've been in theater, 30-some years, I guess.
Whoa.
Something like that. I think I've only fired in my entire career one actor.
How did that happen?
Well,
you opened the door, counselor.
No, it was just impossible. I mean, there couldn't be a meeting in the minds.
Well, what was some of the?
It wasn't in my show. The actor was having a disagreement with a person who worked at our theater.
Yeah, but what were some of the issues that came up?
I think it has to do with I interpret it this way and you interpret it that way. And in the arts, that's an important difference. You mm-hmm. all have to work together in the room. You're all, you know, the designers are in there, the actors are in there, the director is in there, and you're all working toward a mutual end. And so if there is one person who is counter to what's going on, it can really cause a lot of conflict. And there just comes a time when you have to say, let's agree to disagree, but not work together. One time, though, in 35 years.
So what happened? Well,
really
I'm
remarkable.
Interested in this. I'm fascinated by this. So what happened? Did you call the guy in the room?
Yeah, he kind of got called to the principal's office, you know, which was me, because as I said, I wasn't directing. And, you know, we had to come to a mutual agreement that this was not a good thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know. That's...
Have you seen him over the years since that time?
No, mm-hmm, I have not. Mm-hmm. You know, not on purpose, but it just hasn't happened.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. So what is the role of the director? I mean, I got to know this because, you know, I've always wondered about this. I had a very good friend, he's passed now, John Lipsky, who would allow his actors to sort of create as they went. In other words, they would sort of make it up as they went, which is very different from this is the way you're going to do it.
Right. Well, what does a director do? Well, I remember my mother saying to me, so what do you do?
You
tell them where to go on stage? And I would always say, yes, Mom. She goes, okay. And you need a college degree for that? And I would have to explain to my mother often, you know, well, a director does a lot. You know, a director is really the eye and ear and heart for the audience. I mean, the journey that is taken in a theatrical endeavor is in part what the director is able to filter through all of these different elements with the designers and the actors and the choreographer and, you know, the music that you hear and the sound effects. All of that filters through a director, and it really is the director in whom the actors put their trust. So, you know, to have an actor go out on a limb with an emotional part and really get down to the truth of something, oftentimes it's really a director who brings that about. And if a director is really good, you'll never see their work when you step into the theater.
What about kissing? I often wonder about kissing. You know, people have to kiss on stage, and, you know, some of them don't like to kiss each other that much. And I've often wondered about it because, you know, when you see the movies, it always looks like...
Really good.
Well, no, it looks like they're not kissing on the lips. They look like they're kissing just below the lips.
It does?
That's the way it's always looked to me. But what if they say they don't want to kiss?
I've never had any actor say that. Seriously, they seem
to
really like kissing.
Are these immoral people? Immoral people?
I'm not going there.
You know?
No, I only deal with them in the rehearsal room. You know, actors, it's really interesting. I used to think because in college, you know, in high school, there's an embarrassment factor. But once you start dealing with professional actors, they go for it. They're fun to work with, you know. Mm-hmm. So if there's a kiss, they kiss.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever directed a nude scene?
Several, yes.
And what's that one?
Well, I'll tell you my most embarrassing situation.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Anything's okay.
Okay. Well, we were doing a play called Take Me Out. It's about a baseball team. And there is a shower sequence in it where all nine actors are naked,
full
taking
Monty.
Showers. Full
yeah.
Monty. Full Monty, front and back. I was not directing the show, but I was asked by the director to come over for, you know, a final rehearsal, which was over in the rehearsal hall. And could I come over Sunday, at, you know, X day?
Was this here in Albany?
Yes, it was here in Albany.
Albany? Full Monty in Albany?
Yes, we did. Okay. And it was a wonderful production.
Okay.
Wonderful. Take Me Out, one of my favorite productions. Beautifully directed. And I went to the rehearsal and showed up at 2 o'clock, and I took my seat, you know, behind the table. And the director said, oh, and Maggie, today we've decided that this is the first day we're going to be fully nude. And there were fluorescent lights. They could see me. I could see them. You know, there was no way that I could hide, you know, back in the back row of a theater.
Sure.
And go, that's nice. And I said, okay. And yeah, and so, and by the way, gorgeous guys.
Yeah.
You know, all different races, all different body types, but all look like professional baseball players. And, you know, sure enough, I mean, the time came for the shower scene. There was no water, but they all just went off to the sides of the rehearsal hall, took their clothes off, and then came on. It was a great day for me.
Did you say, OS, somebody of a more moderate nature in our community is going to get on me for this?
No. And you know what? I didn't say that. I have a great faith in our audience. And I did not get complaints about that play, because that play was really about something important. And, you know, it's about a baseball player that comes out, a gay player that comes out, and he's the star. He's a Derek Jeter-esque star, and it's about what happens because he comes out and all the ramifications of it. And it was really a gripping drama, and I loved it. And I think when you're doing something that has an important theme and part of it has nudity in it, that people go with you. I mean, we let people know that there was nudity, but there was a nude scene in The Grapes of Wrath when people jumped into the Colorado River. There was a nude scene in one of my favorite plays that I directed called Nora, which was Ingmar Bergman's adaptation of A Dollhouse, and I love that play. And there was a nude scene of the woman and the husband in that. And that had to be very, very carefully crafted.
How carefully?
Well, you know, you're dealing with
actors are vulnerable.
That's why.
I don't want to give you a hard time here, but when you stage a nude scene between a husband and a wife, what are you worried about? I mean, what could go wrong?
Well, it has to serve the play, art, you know? So.
Well, but that's always in the mind of the beholder. I mean, that's the director, serve the play. Oh, it's got to serve the play. But, you know, what does that mean?
Well, it means that it has to be in the context of telling a story. And you're dealing with actors who are artists who are very vulnerable at the moment that they have to disrobe.
Yeah, but you're the filter.
So you have
you're
to be
filter.
Very careful.
You're the filter.
Correct.
In other words, it's your view as to what serves art and what doesn't. There could be some, you know, more prudent person who said nobody's taking off their clothing in this play.
That is true. And the director has the option to do a scene that has nudity or any kind of violence as well. I would put nudity and violence in the same sort of category, because it's up to the director to bring some discretion to that.
Yeah. Besides nudity, what other problematic areas are there for a director? In other words, what are some of the social norms that you've talked about? Gay coming out, you've talked about, you know, nudity. What is it that makes your head spin a little bit before you show up in the theater when you have to make a key decision?
Well, for me, because I'm also the artistic director, I'm not just a director, for me, it's really about, you know, I mean, we're talking about plays that have social themes, and we're talking about plays that might have, you know, adult content in them. But I'm also looking at a full season that has something for families and something that's musical and something that's fun. And so, you know, for me, I go to the theater to be excited by being able to laugh incredibly, or be able to think and be able to cry and be able to walk out, you know, singing. So, You know, for me, I think it's a little different being an artistic director who's also a director.
I want to talk to you about that. And by the way, I want to remind everybody that we're talking to Maggie Mancinelli Cahill, who is the producing artistic director for Capitol Repertory Theater in Albany and who has won just about every award under the sun. Now, those are two different roles, aren't they? Director and artistic director. You've made that point a couple of times here. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated because when that guy brought you in to look at, the director brought you in to look at the nine guys lined up who are nude, it could have been interpreted a number of different ways. One is, thank God I don't have to make this decision. I'm going to put it on her. I'll bring her in. I'll show her what's up. And then she, as the artistic director, have to see whether the politics of the community will allow it. Or it just could be, so what does the artistic director do with the director? It hires them, obviously.
I think that what the most important thing that artistic directors do is we choose the season. And so by the time that a director is, you know, in the artistic home that I hope Capitol Rep is, they're being protected because the artistic director is the one who has committed to this season and that play. And, you know, and I always stand by the choices that we pick.
How do you do it? And you said we. Is it you or is it we?
I pick the season, but I get a lot. The buck stops with me.
Yeah.
But I get an awful lot of input when I'm
from whom?
Selecting a season. You know who the most important people who help me choose the season are really our patrons. Our patrons go to theater all over the world. Not just the United States, but they go significantly around the United States.
That means they're rich, right? Because they can get all over the world.
Not at all. Because I think once you are a patron of the arts, you know how to go to theater in a way that you'll find the theater that's right
for
you. Well,
you still got to pay to get to Japan.
Well, perhaps okay, so. But wherever they go in the world, and why they find themselves there, is I can't tell you. But they bring back materials. They bring back stories, yes.
They say,
I saw this play, I thought you would, you know, love it. Or they'll go to a play reading in New York, you know, and say, I just love this. I had an actor friend, and they made me go to this play reading, and I think you should look at this play. And the other source of plays are the actors and directors who work with us. They're often in play readings and, you know, Newark in New York, and they'll say, I had something to do with this play in New York, Maggie, you should really take a look at it. That's how we found this new work that we did this season called The God Game. This is how we found it. There was an actress who was in God of Carnage who came across this play and said, I think you would love this play, and gave it to us. And now our season, to go back to who chooses our season, do they choose it? No. But you get all of this information throughout the year, you know. People will say plays that they've seen, things that they like. You know, I like this one. I didn't like that one. And then I also, you know, I go to New York theater, of course. So I, you know, I have colleagues in New York who I talk with. I go see plays and I read a lot of plays.
Have you ever had buyer's remorse in that you pick a play and then you realize I shouldn't have picked it?
If I say yes to that question, I know what the next question is going to be.
No,
you're going to ask me what one it is.
I won't do it.
Okay, yes, I have.
Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with that?
It was very, very hard because I was disappointed in how the play actually felt in the theater versus how I had imagined it, you know? And sometimes I think that happens. But I haven't been disappointed very often, Alan, and I haven't been sorry very often, really, truly.
So you have a board of trustees?
I do. I have a board, and it ranges anywhere from 35 people to 22 people over the years. I mean, it depends. It comes and goes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are people who love theater and support theater, yes.
If they tell you to do something and you don't want to do it, do you have to?
You know what? I will be honest with you. The Board of Trustees has not
interfered.
They know
that separation.
They do, in terms of programming, yes. In terms of keeping the budget down.
Oh, yeah, that's number
one. You know, that is actually part of the job of trustees is to make sure that you're solvent, you know. So you pay attention to keeping within the approved budgets.
Now, speaking of which,
yes,
I'm fascinated by the relationship between you and Proctor's Theater in Schenectady. How did that evolve and where is it right now?
Well, you know, 3 years ago, 2011, January 2011, we formed a management agreement with Proctor's, which it had been in the works for many years. And basically, I had gone to Philip Morris. He's a colleague of mine. He has been for years. And I thought that it would be a really great idea to create an arts education institute for the Capital Region. They do really great education programs at Proctor's, and we do great education programs at Capital Rep. And I thought if the two of us could get together with maybe a college, that we could put together an institute where we presented all this great arts education under one umbrella. And from that point when we started talking, our board started talking together, and what happened in the middle of these conversations was, frankly, the stock market crash of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
That was really significant for the arts. And we managed to keep our subscriptions steady for that year and the following year, where other theaters didn't. Lots of theaters closed. 5 theaters in New England closed in the 2 years following that. And it was a very, very turbulent time. And we started, you know, realizing, I mean, we're a year-round theater, you know.
How many seats in your theater?
286.
So it's not a lot.
No, but we do 250 performances every single year. We keep the lights on North Pearl Street in downtown Albany. So
is there any help from the city?
Not anymore. The city used to have funding for the arts, but, you know, in the crisis that happened with the city, that was a program that went to the wayside in 2010.
And governors and mayors are always talking about the great crisis of Albany is we can't get enough people into downtown Albany. So there's Cap Rep in downtown Albany. You would think that in terms of their goals, it would be very important to support this particular theater.
In downtown, it's important. We have some really significant arts organizations near downtown. The Albany Symphony Orchestra, the Palace Theater, Capitol Rep, the Times Union Center, and not too far up the hill, we've got the New York State Museum and the Institute of History and Art. So all of these arts organizations are critical in a very small square mile.
Are there too many arts organizations?
Oh, there's never too
many.
Never too many. There's never too many, Alan. Thank you for asking me that.
I knew what you were going to say. Okay. So,
well, we're all very different. We all do very different things.
I want to go back to our friend Philip Morris and ask how that evolved.
So what happened was that we had been talking about collaboration in a significant way. But when that crisis hit over the next 2 years, it became very clear to us that we had to do something about our operating costs. We just had to. We're a Lort Theater, which means we're governed by, you know, several unions. And so there's certain things we can cut. There's certain things we can't cut. And we realized that we had to find a way to do what we did and trim administrative costs. So there was no way to reduce staff. You know, we got to the point where that was just you're just cutting bone. You're not cutting fat anymore. You're down to the bone. And
can I ask what the budget for the theater is every year?
$2.3 million.
Yeah.
So we decided that if we could share personnel in our back office, finance, marketing, development, these kind of services, that box office, if we could find a way to share those expenses, we could cut, you know, $300,000.
Did you?
We did. And we did it by partnering with Proctor's.
You know, you say partnering. Inevitably, when there are two partners, somebody becomes the boss. Does that happen here?
Well, you know, Philip was always and continues to be the CEO, and he's the CEO that...
Of the whole thing.
Of the whole thing, you know, and I run Capital Rep, but, you know, frankly, I love working with Philip. He's a great visionary. He's one of the best property developers I've ever met in my life.
He's incredibly smart.
He's smart. He loves music. He loves he was working the arts his entire life. Mm-hmm. He's fun to work with. I like it. And I also like having somebody that's smart in business. And so this partnership that we did, and we're called an affiliation, by the way. We're still a separate 501c3. We have our own board of directors. But, you know, this affiliation we have, some people say, oh, you know, they saved you. And I said, well, in some ways, but also our goal was not only to be saved, but it was to create a regional entity. And so by having a hub of theater in Albany and the hub of theater in Schenectady, we really combined into a model that's not very common, but Los Angeles has one, the LA Theater Group. The Denver Center Theater Company has a presenter.
Pittsfield, Kate McGuire.
You know, yeah. Right, there you go. And then here we see, you know, that same kind of thing with Berkshire Theater Group, you know, with the Colonial and Berkshire Theater Festival. So it was smart business, but I think also combining our resources, we really have a region-wide punch, you know. And now I think it took us a while to get our joint boots, you know, so to speak. And I think we're really cooking now. I have to tell you, this year has been a really fabulous year for us at Capital Rep.
So do you have deficits?
Not anymore. How do you like that?
Mm.
Well, I shouldn't say that. We have a small loan that, but it's matched by a grant that we haven't received yet, but will. And we managed by working with Philip and also some leaders in our communities who were very, very, very supportive of the concept of us joining forces and cutting any kind of redundancy in terms of staffing and things.
So they got together and helped. So just for the hell of it, the redundancy would be?
We have a finance department and a payroll service, and Proctor's also has a finance department and a payroll service. Why not just use one?
Sure.
So that's what I'm talking about. Sure. And so when we talked to these, you know, really smart guys from the community, they helped create a region-wide box office, which is called Tickets by Proctors. That was part of our getting together, finding the funding to be able to expand the box office so that it could be a full service to. And by the way, it's a full service for like 8 organizations, I think. So there were a lot of players.
What are the other organizations?
Albany Pro Musica, Schenectady, you know, Schenectady.
But they don't have affiliation contracts with Proctors.
No, they purchased the services of Tickets by Proctors, and that was kind of the whole idea, that that would be a center for other people who couldn't have a 24/7 box office. Now they can.
Philip Morris has been raising an issue that is near and dear to many people's hearts, which is that if the new casinos come in, they're going to be there's going to be a problem, because if the casino has a theater, they have non-compete clauses. So if they have 2,000 seats or whatever they've got, you're not allowed to have anything that they've had within 100 miles. Would that affect a small regional theater?
I want to say yes, but not because of the entertainment or because of a no-compete clause at the casino. The Fair Game Group is a group of presenters around the state of New York.
Who don't want them coming in?
Well,
for that reason.
That's not true. What they want are limits. They want limits put on how many seats there can be and on some of the do-not-compete clauses. They want it limited. That's why it's called Fair Game.
That's why they call it fair.
Well, yeah. There's evidence in some communities that when casinos move in and have these very big presenting theaters, that other presenters in communities have been hurt.
Sure.
So for us,
isn't that called competition?
You know what? I think that it's not my area of expertise, how presenters work and how the no-compete clauses work. But I will tell you this. It would hurt the Palace Theater.
No question.
And it might also hurt the
Proctors.
Times Union Center.
And it might hurt Proctors.
Well, you know, you asked me about my neighborhood. My neighborhood and my friends and my colleagues on my street are very valuable. And yes, it could hurt Proctors, and it could hurt a lot of presenters around, you know, to have too many seats in a smaller community competing for the entertainment dollar.
I want to go, Maggie, back to your choosing the season. What are the criteria you use for the season?
Well, I have to have something fun, and we usually pick the summer to do that because we have lots of friends in the Berkshires who do a variety of things, and they do some serious theater, and it gives us an opportunity to take a little breather there and do a lighthearted play. This year we're doing Smokey Joe's Cafe.
Right.
And something light and wonderful that makes me really happy. Like, they're rehearsing right next door to my office right now, and I'm happy when I hear the music in Smokey Joe's. So something fun. Something that's, you know, hot off the New York stage that isn't a national tour. Last year that was Venus in Fur, a very sexy little play that couldn't tour the country. Most dramas don't tour from Broadway. And so we were able to get that and get that for our audiences. And this year it's other desert cities, which we'll do in the fall. And then I like to do a really inspiring play in the holidays. And this year it's Secret Garden. Love to do a world premiere.
One of my favorites.
Yeah.
Have you ever taken anything on, which is unknown, produced it, and then had it go to Broadway?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that because, you know, being a regional theater, we're a member of LORT, that's the League of Resident Theaters.
I wanted to ask you about that, too.
Yeah, and LORT is a network of union theaters across the United States. When you think of regional theater, you would think about LORT, you know, LA Theater Group, Seattle Rep, Arizona Theater Company, the Goodman in Chicago, even Lincoln Center, though, in the Roundabout are part of our network. And so that is who we are interested in moving plays around with, where we don't do huge musicals. We're a thrust stage in an intimate setting.
Sure.
So we do, I don't want to say smaller plays because we just did Gypsy with a whole lot of people. But generally speaking, we're not doing a lot of dancing kind of musicals, which, you know, would be perfect for Broadway. But where we look to do our things is in regional theaters. We have moved plays to New York. We did an incredible production of Jacques Brel's Alive and Well Living in Paris, and it moved and it played in New York off-Broadway for over a year and a half.
Did you know when you produced it that it was going to go to New York?
I have no idea.
Really?
Yeah.
And how did
it
happen?
The wonderful director, Gordon Greenberg, was somebody heard about the production. And the producers came to Capitol Rep and saw it and said, we want to do that.
Did you get a cut?
No, we didn't. Mm-hmm. No, we didn't. Not on that.
Sometimes they do.
Yes. Not on that one.
Okay, so tell us a little about this season's presentations. What are you going to have?
Well, you know, Smoky Joe's, other desert cities.
Tell us a little about Smoky Joe's. What's it about?
It's about the music of Lieber and Stoller and their amazing rock and roll composers. And they wrote everything from, you know, On Broadway to You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog, you know, to Yakety Yak, Don't Talk Back. But when they're singing next to me, it's one hit after the other. I mean, more artists have covered Lieber and Stoller, I think, in rock and roll and now in pop music than in anyone that I know. So it's all singing all the time, this cast of these 9 amazing singer-dancers. And
who puts them up? Where do you put them when they come
to town?
They
live in apartments that we lease.
Oh, I see. And you permanently lease these apartments?
We do. Yes. So we have a variety of apartments that we lease in downtown Albany.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They have to be close to the theater. That's a part of the union agreement. Yeah.
What else you got?
What else we got? A Secret Garden in the holidays. And then we're doing a world premiere called How Water Behaves. It's wonderful in January. And then we're doing an incredible play called Souvenir about a woman who used to do these incredible concerts at the Ritz in New York. Foster Jenkins, you must know about her.
She's a hero here at WMC.
Right?
As a matter of fact, when we want to annoy people during the fun drive, we quite frequently play her music.
Because for those people who don't know who she was an amazing woman who loved opera and singing it, but she unfortunately could not sing. But it's wonderful.
This is something I've always wanted to know about her. Did she know she couldn't sing?
That's what the play is about. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
She did in her final concert at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah. She hired the halls, by the way.
She hired the halls.
Yeah.
And she wore these fabulous costumes.
She had money, yeah.
Yeah. And it wasn't until that final concert that she learned and she understood that she couldn't sing. It's kind of an amazing story.
So that would make her crazy, right? Because if she didn't know she couldn't sing.
I don't think she was crazy. I don't think she could hear. I think that was part of that. You know, there are people who think they can sing.
Yeah.
Do we have to tell them? They really
can't.
I don't have to tell them about me.
But
I don't tell anybody who thinks they can sing that they can't sing because it doesn't do any good.
Yeah.
They don't hear that.
Pete used to say there are no non-singers.
There you go. And Foster Jenkins was truly entertaining and engaging. So that's Souvenir, and I think it's going to be a real crowd pleaser. And then the final show is part of our Classics on Stage program. We're doing Hamlet. So it's a season that has great scope in it, you know, and
so how do you do with the critics? I mean, in other words, in the Berkshires, they have a critic who's often very tough on the performances. And I guess he gets over here, too, but it's not the same thing because, you know, you have other people here. What your take on critics are?
My favorite critics are the ones who like our plays.
I get that. But what happens when you get somebody who just gets it wrong?
You know, a good review doesn't do as much good business as a bad review
hurts
your business.
Sure.
So bad reviews, really negative reviews, really hurt your box office. And, you know, frankly, in this day and age, your box office is really important. I mean, for us, we're 50-50. 50% of our budget comes from ticket sales and 50% comes from contributed. And, you know, that's a lot of responsibility that we have. So there's nothing you can do. You know as well as I do, Alan, that people say something in the press.
Have you ever picked up the phone and called the editor of the Times Union and said, you know, this just isn't fair?
In 35 years, I have done it once.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And did you get a satisfactory answer?
I got a satisfactory answer. I mean, not a changed review, but I felt that I was heard. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So when your principal actors, for example, get a bad review and you think they've been harmed, happens every once in a while in all theaters, mm-hmm. and you get to be sort of mother hen, you get ticked off. You know, how do you handle the actor?
Well, believe it or not, there is a tradition at Capitol Rep that we don't share reviews on the dressing room because there are actors who really don't read their reviews.
Yeah, they
really don't. Sometimes they wait till after the show has closed and then they read them. There are other actors who don't read them at all. There are other actors who are very sensitive and they will come to me and say, do you think it's true that I was XYZ? And, you know, you have to handle it on an individual basis. It's my job to help the actor. The actor is who has to go out there and commit to what he's doing every day. Mm-hmm. And so I can't spend a lot of time publicly or with the cast, that would be public to me, you know, fretting about a review.
You know, you're...
But I do fret with them from a business point of view. It would be ludicrous not to say a bad review does hurt you, yes.
Do they have too much power, critics?
I don't know. You know, it's an odd world that we're living in right now with bloggers and...
You know, the New York Times used to have two reviewers, one on the weekends and one during the week. I always thought that was a good idea, and they frequently disagreed with each other. Now, the reason I like that so much was it shows that these people are not superhuman.
Sure, sure. I don't think that's the case anymore, though, at the Times.
No, it isn't.
I mean, newspapers have fallen on hard times, so it's hard to get a reviewer who can, number one, see it all anyway, and let alone people who read it all.
I make it a practice of offering that alternative review quite frequently in my split column in the Berkshire Eagle during the weekends. And I was standing behind somebody, and they said, well, you know, so-and-so gave it a bad review. I said, well, Shartok gave it a good review. And they said, well, he doesn't know anything about theater.
Oh, well, I'll tell you where the best reviews are, all right?
Yeah.
They're in the women's room at intermission. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
They know what's going on. Yeah. I love going in the women's room in Broadway theaters because you hear about not only the show you're seeing, but the three other ones that they saw in the past month. I mean, that is the best place to get the unvarnished truth of anything. Yeah, I can't do it too much at Capitol Rep anymore because everybody knows me, so they'll clam up.
You have to get a wig like the food
critic. Yes, I have to go in disguise into the ladies' room and get people to talk.
Now, you're a mom. Well, your kid is now college age.
Yes.
And you're finding a way to find money for that. So my question is, when you get home, I mean, you're all powerful in the theater. You're the artistic director. You're the grand poobah. But when you get home, are you still the grand poobah? And are your expectations that people will listen to you the way they have to listen to you at work?
Alan, I have to be honest. I think you were just talking about yourself your life.
No, certainly.
I don't think it was mine.
Well, I can tell you you're exactly right. When I get home, I have no power whatsoever. I'm just dirt under everybody's feet. So the question then is, how about you?
My son graduated from college in December. He's now out in Los Angeles working in the film industry. He graduated in film. And Certainly when he's home as a young man.
They say
man,
when people will come home, you know, when they come home, they will become 16. Is that true?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And I have no power over 16-year-old. So if you have any tips for me, please let me know. No.
Yeah.
I know. And by the way, I'm not the grand poobah at work either.
Yes, you are.
No.
Yeah, sure. Sure you are.
No.
Okay, all right.
No, no, no,
anymore. Well, look, I can subscribe to that. I'm not the grand poobah here either.
You're not?
See? I trapped you. I trapped you.
Okay.
All right. So
I have been told that I have a certain look when I'm unhappy.
Yeah, yeah.
That really can freeze water. So, you know.
Interesting. What do you do? How do you focus your face?
I don't know what it
is. See, in my house and here, everybody knows that when I lower my glasses over my nose and look over the glasses, that's it. That's bad. Very,
that's bad.
Very bad. You have such a signal?
It's this look, and I know it clears the room. And it has to do with my being disappointed. I'm told that that's the worst.
Yeah.
Disappointing.
But as the head of the organization, you know that when something goes wrong, no matter who's responsible, that you're going to get it in the neck.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Buck stops here.
That is true. That's true because we're a very public institution. You know, 280 people hopefully come to the play every night, 250 nights a year. And they all look to me to go, well, it's your fault. I mean, it really is
well,
true.
That works both ways.
The wine, if the wine isn't good at the cafe,
sure.
If the wall needs repainting, if the faucet is dripping, all of those reports come to me. I can't tell you how many times I've been sitting in my office and somebody will say, I thought you would want to know this.
Do you own the theater? Do you guys own the theater?
No. And you know, if I had a wish,
It would be that you own the theater.
Yes.
Because
we need to own our building.
Yeah.
Because there are improvements that we would like to do.
So if there's a crack in the wall and it belongs to somebody else, it's different than if it belongs to you.
Then it's your own.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are certain things and there are certain very expensive things that we would like to do that it doesn't work if you're a tenant. And so we would like to own our building, yes.
Yeah. Is there a movement to get that done?
There is a movement, yes.
How would anybody who is listening to this, who had something to help with, some people might hear this and say, you know, I love CapRep and I'd like to put something into this. How would they go about doing that?
Well, as I told you, one of the things I think Philip does great is develop property. And we have looked all over. We'd like to be in Albany. You know, it's where we want to put our hub. It's how we feel that we're a regional presence with Proctors and Schenectady and us and in Capital Rep in Albany. So we have looked for a building. Could we retrofit a building? It's hard because, you know, theaters are space hogs. They need a lot of free span, and a lot of buildings, you know, that were built in the turn of the century certainly are not free span buildings. So if somebody's got a nice free span building that has the potential to have parking around it, that is
Well, you certainly have parking
beautiful.
Around your present theater.
We do, yeah. We have parking in downtown. You know, we have a couple of lots right around us.
So your theater is very intimate. That's what I love about it. You go
That's
there.
What, yes.
You're
it's
sitting.
Our, it's our
you're
signature.
You're sitting on the stage, basically.
Well, it's called a thrust stage, and that means there's audience on three sides of it.
Well, that makes you special. But what if somebody came along and said, you know, take over Proctor's and do your theater there? I don't mean Proctor's. Okay. What if somebody came along and said, take over the Palace, do your theater there? Would it change the character? Because it would give you a lot more economic oomph by having more seats to fill. So have you ever thought about that? I know you have. So
yeah. And I've had people say, why don't you go into the Palace? And I think that, you know, a brand is critical to success.
But do you ever get something that is so good that you say, okay, for this one, we'll go into the Palace?
I'm not sure that I've thought about the Palace, but I certainly have thought that some of our plays would be good in a bigger, larger space. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I thought that of Christmas Carol, our production last holiday. Well, it was just a very special rendition of Christmas Carol, and I really thought that it could bear to be in a bigger theater.
Do you ever try to do it? Now that you raise Christmas Carol, you know that Berkshire Theater Festival did it, and James Taylor and his wife and his kids all participated. Mm-hmm. They sold a lot of seats. Do you look around for famous people who might want to do things with you?
You know, we haven't done too much of that. But if famous people are out there and they want to do a wonderful play, I'll certainly consider that.
Right.
But that hasn't really been our MO, mostly because our rehearsal period and the runs of our plays are long. And it takes a chunk out of someone's time.
Yeah, sure.
So if we were doing a special case, I mean, we've had certainly great famous people through the building. You know, we had John Amos and Larry Linville and Brian Dennehy came up. Mm. But they have come up for shorter projects, you know, to fit in their schedule of, you know, television and movies.
Wow. So what is the ultimate issue here? You need your own building. You need space. You have the remarkable Philip Morris, who is working on this with you. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I often wonder about is how, when we talk about how you choose things, is that a lot of this stuff goes around. And the Berkshires are right next door. You're right here. Kiss Me, Kate has been put on any number of times, for example. Mm-hmm. And you can go and you can say, well, this is a different production than the other one is. But do you have to watch what the others are doing in order to know what not to do?
Absolutely. I think it's called working together.
Do you?
Yeah. I pay a lot of attention to what Berkshire Theater Group and Julie are doing because my subscribers like to go there in the summer. You know, in the summer, the Capital Region is one of the most glorious places for art in the country.
Or the world.
I mean, or in the world. You know, with Williamstown, Ad Williamstown, sure. Dorset Theater Festival, Chester Theater
Company. And each of them have a character, don't they?
They do.
You know, Williamstown can be a little bit, for want of a better word, I don't want to be insulting, but can be a little snottier than some of the others can. And so each of them has a character for seriousness, not being serious.
Well, no, with all due respect, I have seen fabulous work at all of these theaters.
Me too,
and I make an effort every summer to see at least one thing that each of these theaters is doing because we're first class. This is why I went to school at Columbia. I wanted to come to school on the East Coast because of this area. This area is the envy of the rest of the country. I say this a lot, but I mean it.
So why'd you choose Columbia and not Yale?
Oh, I was waitlisted at Yale, if we're telling the truth here, and I didn't want to wait.
I was not waitlisted at Harvard.
You know, you were not.
Okay. No.
You know what, though? I loved Columbia because
It's
New York City. I think I saw three plays a week when I was in grad school. I just saw so many.
Did you ever fall asleep?
I did. And you know, I always used to chastise people in my life who fell asleep in plays, and then I fell asleep. I was really sick, and I really wanted to see this new Michael Weller play, and forgive me, Michael Weller, I fell asleep during the
Did anybody
play.
Give you the elbow?
No.
They just let you sleep?
They just let me sleep.
I fall asleep a lot.
Do you?
Yeah, my most famous falling asleep was my dinner with Andre, which I just couldn't understand. These two guys yakking each other. So,
I love that movie.
So, everybody says that
Wallace
to me.
Sean
that's
and Dick
my
Gregory.
Favorite
yeah,
movie,
right.
my this, that. Fast asleep. Yeah. Haven't felt a bit of remorse about that since it happened. So, do you do the curtain calls? I mean, the pre-play curtain.
Curtain speeches?
Speeches, yes.
You bet I do.
Every night?
I now have a group of people who are trained to do the curtain speech if I'm not there, a small group of people, because it's hard for me because, you know, for Gypsy, we did 42 performances.
Yeah.
I just couldn't be there every night. But,
so you look out there. I've always wanted to know this. Mm-hmm. When you're standing up there and you're looking out at that audience, right? Mm-hmm. Do you size them up? You know, this.
You know, Alan, I'll tell you the truth. I don't size anybody up.
You
love.
Size me up.
Well, you know, you're just not anybody. But I sized you up and I said, this guy's good.
Yeah.
So, you know, hey. Yeah. I don't judge the audience. You know, I hope they laugh at my jokes. You know, I try to have somewhat of a joke in my curtain speech if I can.
You try to get money out of them, though, don't you? You say, you know, we're community theater.
At certain times of year, I talk about our annual fund. I'm told that WAMC does that, too.
Huh?
Yes, I talk about our annual fund when it's appropriate. I talk about resubscribing. I talk about getting your kids down here that it's important to, you know, grab a child and
they
come.
They learn some theater. Do you do educational projects within the schools and all?
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for asking that. I think that our education programs are probably the single thing I'm most proud of. Last year in our education programs, we reached 15,000 young people.
How do you do it?
We have a program called On the Go, And we take plays directly into classrooms and community groups.
Really?
And we go everywhere. We go in 14 counties, and we do these curriculum-based original plays. So that we do one about Solomon Northup. You know,
who writes them?
12 Years a Slave had nothing on us.
How do you write them?
There are a variety of people. I've penned two of them with co-authors. Yeah, and I'm writing another one about the Erie Canal. I'm working on that now. I've been working with a historian for a year on that, and I'll be doing that this
summer.
Is there
going to be any music in it?
Four pieces from Erie Canal Songs and Calls, yes.
40 Miles from Albany, Forget It, We Never Shall. Terrible song, we had that not on the Erie Canal.
That's very funny. Well, I did find out that in 50 Miles in the Erie Canal had some very tawdry lyrics, which we won't be putting in this because this is for third
we
to sixth
We heisted her upon the sail as a signal of distress.
You know.
The cook.
So.
Okay. Okay, so then what else?
We go into schools with On the Go, and we tell the story of Harriet Tubman, and we told the story of Henry Hudson, and we... And as I said, we're doing the Erie Canal, and we do literature as well. Pure Poe, we're doing this fall.
Do you find that people are more willing to give money to a theater group that does education?
Yes, I do, because the education programs are completely subsidized. Schools don't have any money right now.
Sure.
And so the only way that we can do arts programs are for... people, generous individuals, and foundations in particular. And the corporate world gives us sponsorships for our education programs. Yeah. So I think they know that it's critical. You know, people say, why do you do education programs? You know, we don't do it to get the money.
Sure.
I mean, because they cost as much money as we bring in. But we do it because we believe that the English language is actually an important tool to communicate our heritage, our stories, and to be able to interpret history, I think is a really critical tool that young people have to have. They got to save the world. And theater is about spoken word. It's about people getting up, talking to each other. You have to hear the word. You have to interpret when you see people on a stage. It is something that happens in the brain that might not happen as much on a visual screen when you're playing a video game or something.
Do you think that we don't give our kids enough credit for being able to understand theater?
I don't know. I love parents who, you know, take the hand of their child and take them to the Nutcracker and take them to see Christmas Carol and take them to see, you know, Secret Garden and get them out to see human beings on stage talking to each other. No, I think it takes time, and I don't think it's the first thing on modern kids' agenda to walk into a theater. So, you know, it takes more effort to walk into a theater.
Sure. I remember when my boy came home and announced he was taking a date to Tanglewood after we had been playing Tanglewood concerts every time. I almost cried.
Right.
It was great.
Well, my son called me when he was a freshman in college, and he goes, "You won't believe where, you know, I took, you know, the girlfriend at the time." And I said, "Where'd you go?" And he said, "Two Gentlemen of Verona." That's a really good play. And I said, "Wait a minute. You took a date to see Shakespeare?" I was really thrilled. And he said, "Yes, she was very impressed."
Well, that's the whole point.
Know,
that's the whole point. I had a girlfriend in New York very early who I used to see, like, the Thalia a lot, the Thalia Theater, you know. And I used to take her to see things like The Red Shoes, which I never quite understood. But I always thought.
Very, very high-end dating.
The girl was more important. Yes, high-end dating,
including
$5 then for a cup of coffee on McDougal Street.
Yeah. So. Well, you know, our student prices, $16 any show. It's cheaper to see us than it is a 3D movie right now. And I always tell people, and you know, we're actually almost 40. You know, you can really have fun in the theater. You can see on all sides. It's really in your face. Kids, you know, I was really surprised, even for the God Game this year, which was our world premiere, by the way, that I think is going to go on to many regional theaters. I was really surprised. It's a political drama, and our student matinee loved it. They loved to have a play that was about the separation of church and state, so they could go back and talk about it in their, global studies courses in American history. And they could also have this experience of, you know, having the drama and the characters do that for them. So I have a lot of faith in our young people, but I would preface that by saying, and I wish our language skills would continue to be really valued.
Improved. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, that's the time we've got. Maggie Mancinelli Cahill, we love you. We have always loved you. You are our favorite. You do great service. You've been recognized again and again by all those people who have something to say about who's important in our community, and you certainly are, and we are delighted that you've taken all this time to come with us. And if I've said anything at all during this time that has annoyed you, I certainly want to apologize for it in advance, but I don't think so, right? You've handled yourself extremely well.
No, and so have you, Alan. I just want to say, and I would like to leave with the fact that the first television interview I ever had was in 1995 with you.
And Channel 6.
And I got to kiss you on air. So I've always said you were my first kiss.
What
in
kind
Albany.
Of kiss was it?
You know, it was a great
was it a directorial
kiss. What are you
kiss?
Kidding?
Yeah,
you know, okay. I've never forgotten it.
Maggie, we love you. And we hope you'll come back many times as the wonderful theater does such great stuff. We've been talking to Maggie Mancinelli Cahill, producing artistic director for Capitol Repertory Theater. And it's great to have you here.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org. Thank you.